You're listening to Face Off, episode 90, recorded October 11th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I am Mark Sanborn.
In this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can get our show notes for this particular episode by going to faceoffshow.com.
All right, what's new in the world of Jade this week?
Well, there's fall in the air. I mean, that's for sure. It was kind of crazy. It seemed like it was summer forever, and then it just flicked a switch instantly, and all of a sudden it's leaves on the ground, and there's bears all over the place.
Yeah, I heard there was a bear on campus.
There's been apparently in the past, I can't remember what the article is. I think it was in the past 2 weeks or 3 weeks, there's been 80 bear sightings in Bozeman.
In the town of Bozeman.
Yeah, like they were running on campus. They're running around town, getting people's garbage cans, trying to get some food before the winter because they got to go hibernate. So you came down this weekend. We were actually going to go camping, but I decided that I didn't really want to with the bears being so active out there.
Yeah, there's been a number of attacks this year as well. So
yeah, better safe than sorry. But yeah, they're running around all over campus and town, all kinds of fun stuff. But let's get into some real news and follow-ups. The first item I want to talk about is the .ly domain scare. So this is interesting. There was a site called, VB.ly or something like that. It was done by blogger lady. Goodness, what is it? I'm
this. I think you're talking like the URL shortener for adult sites.
Right, it's not really see, this is the funny part. So Violet Blue, she's like a sex blogger, right? It's not specifically, this is where it gets weird. It's not specifically a URL shortener for adult websites. It's just a URL shortener where they have no restrictions on what you shorten. They don't care. That was like their whole thing was like, you know, all these URL shorteners, they won't let you do adult content or anything like that if you want to shorten them. So their rule was whatever you want. But where the controversy comes in was, we kind of look at these vanity URLs, the VB, you know, .ly and go, ooh, you know, or bit.ly, bit.ly. But really, the .ly domain is Libya.
Right.
So basically, they shut down this VB.ly because it didn't comply with Libyan laws, which are, you know, Islamic Sharia laws, which are very strict. You know, it's sort of the type where, you know, women have to wear burqas. This is sort of the first time we've seen a domain, what would you call it? The controlling body for the Libyan domain space shut it down. So usually it's where it's hosted is the big deal, right? So if you have illegal content, where your service hosted is the big deal. But so this is the first time that sort of a domain controller has shut something down because the content infringes with sort of their country's laws. But it's, you know, they shut it down because of the domain, not because, you know, it was hosted in Libya.
Which kind of is a little scary.
Absolutely. I think it's,
you know, if you have one of
precedent.
These types of URLs with the .ly, whatever.
Right. I think it sets a bad precedent. I understand why they did it. And truth is, I think they sort of should have the power to do this because, you know, they are in control of the domain. But I think it's sort of a scary thing. And yeah, and a lot of LYs, especially the URL shorteners, because they want a nice short domain because it's .ly, really short, you know, terse. A lot of them want that. And, you know, they are running the risk of getting shut down as well.
So I think the ones that are ran by ICANN, which are probably the most lenient ones, are .com, .org.net, and something else.
Do they run .us?
I think .us might be part of the .ly, you know, the country, the one where it's given to the right. country.
Well, it is. .us is given to the country, but I thought maybe ICANN maybe was the country or the controlling body for the U.S. I don't know, but anyways, it's scary. So if, you know, there's a lot of companies out there that have built their entire business around with a .ly domain, and I'm sure they're quite scared.
Well, it's like, you know, Bitly is probably a very successful example, and if they were to right. get shut down, then it would be pretty devastating.
Yeah, totally. And the funny part is not so much also it's hard to move, right? Because the whole point is there's all these tiny URL links out there, and the, you know, the Libyan company, they're not giving them 301s or anything like that, you know? So if you see one of the, like if Bitly got shut down, any Bitly URL, any URL stats, you know, because that's one of the cool things that Bitly does, gives you stats to people that click through your tiny URLs. It's just gone.
I'm sure Bitly has linked to articles or website, or, you know, has been used to link to articles or websites that are probably, you know,
in violation of Sharia law.
In violation of some sort of somebody's.
I'm sure. So that's the .ly domain scare. Kind of scary. It makes me nervous. So let's, the next sort of news and follow-up we'll talk about is you, you know, enthusiastically told me today that you got accepted into the Google Prediction API. And I was like, I don't really know what that is. So what is it, and why are you excited to get in?
Well, it's a new API put out by Google. It seems like they're putting out APIs left and right all the time. But, you know, it's one of those things, prediction and like machine learning and stuff is not my strong point. it's typically one of those really difficult computer problems to take a data set and try to predict things and try to learn what people are going to do next. It's kind of like the Google, in some ways, it's kind of like the Google Suggest, you know, or the Google Instant when you're typing something and you see like other, what other people have typed and things. But like, right. you know, it goes a little bit beyond that. Basically they have, it's in beta. They have a prediction API that you can give it data and it will pick from various machine learning techniques. Maybe do multiple ones to see which ones match it best. And give you the ability to try to predict things based off the data you give it. So you can kind of train it. So you give it data. The data has to be stored on their Google storage, which is another API that they have that's fairly new, which comes with the this API. Once your data is there, you train it, and then you have a RESTful API where you can query it and ask it things and get predictions.
So I guess what's cool for me is the whole RESTful part. And I like a nice RESTful API. And I mean, it makes sense that this would be REST. You're just sending in, you know, certain things and it predicts what, you know, what a solution should be.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Do you have any, you know, cool use cases you think you're going to use it for?
Right now I'm thinking of trying. So one of the big problems in e-commerce is trying to determine, so if a customer buys 5 of these widgets and 3 of these and 2 of these and 1 of those, it's like it's hard to determine how many packages it's going to be in. Oh. A lot of sites kind of mitigate that by saying, well, if you order over like $100, it's free shipping, because yeah. they just don't want to deal with like having to calculate all these packages, and they, you know, they kind of want to give them a break for ordering a lot.
Yeah.
But some, you know, like when, you know, you order a couple of things, it's hard to determine if it's 1 package, 2 or 3 or whatnot. And the shipping rates can be way off. So I was going to try to take a data set of, you know, past orders and how many packages and what the weight was.
Wow.
And try to predict based on what they have in the cart now, what the weight and how many packages it would be. And then you could get more accurate shipping rates.
Very cool.
My idea.
Mark Sandbar, our shipping mogul. You're like the P. Diddy of shipping.
So that was my first thought.
But there's all kinds of cool stuff you can do.
For a lot of stuff.
Yeah, totally. It's cool that you got in. I mean, can you, one, sometimes we ask this sort of question, like, what's Google's angle? What their angle here, I'm assuming, is that, well, first of all, you have to use their data API, which means they can have, you know, they have access to your data, and they'll probably use it in some sort of computer algorithmic way to see things. But, I mean, they're also getting to see the sort of things that people, the hard questions people are having solving, right?
I think probably the main reason is because they need this in order to do what they do. And the more data and the more development on it they can get, the better it'll be.
Right.
So I think that's probably their primary reason.
Yeah, I had to change my way. You know, it's funny because Google is getting information from everything, right? A lot of times we think, I did anyways, I thought, well, they just do it because they wanted to solve a problem, you know, and that's they're doing it to be nice. But really, anything that they do, the whole end goal is to gather data from it.
Right.
Like we were talking about the Google 411, and I thought that was just Google being cool. And then when my coworker said, no, I'm pretty sure the reason they did it was because they wanted to get as much of people's voices as possible so that they can have, you know, as many recordings of people's voices as possible to do their transcription, which we now use in Google Voice.
Right. And then it's on the Android. It's in the GPS, like the Google Maps. It's everywhere.
Right.
I think they even said that they were doing it to try to get better voice recognition.
I'm sure, but again, I had to think of, you know, you got to think of maybe they're not doing everything just to be nice, like they have their own angle. And so machine prediction is really hard, and they did it for you, but, you know, don't forget sometimes they are getting something out of it too.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, I definitely think they're using this to try to better their own prediction algorithms so that they can have the best one out there. Kind of like, you know, Amazon with their EC2, they're cutting their own server costs and stuff by giving it to everybody and then charging for it, you know. So
yeah, there's always an angle. Not saying it's evil, not saying it's crazy or anything like that. I guess I don't want to sound like the paranoid android and be like, oh, but
so it's some use cases to give for an example on this prediction is like language identification. You can give it some like French or English or whatever and you can get back. So if you gave it an English dictionary, customer sentiment analysis. Here's a good one. Product recommendations. You know, this product is often bought with this one. So display this one on checkout. That's, you know, stuff like Amazon does a lot. I think it lowers the barriers for the smaller businesses to use some of these cool machine learning type things.
I wonder if it could predict, like, based on a task that someone put into an application, whether or not they would complete it based on their previous completed task.
Yeah, definitely. Ooh. I mean, cool stuff.
All right, so that's the Google Prediction API. Give it a check out. See if it has, if it might be able to help you out and register. Did you have to wait long, or was it like, they're in open beta?
I think it was about 3 or 4 days. It is a beta, and you have to like tell them what you're gonna do with it.
Oh, okay.
And you know how many requests per second you think you're gonna give them?
2 billion.
But, you know, I didn't put much, like, I didn't sit there and write a book on why I should be chosen to be in it. So I think they're, I don't know, sign up, see if you can get it out.
All right.
It's like kind of a semi-closed beta.
Sign up. We have link in the show notes. Let's get into our geek tool of the week. Listen, now my fridge has an ice machine. It didn't used to before. And so we actually had a pair of these, which makes it really nice. We have the Tovolo Perfect Cube Silicon Ice Cube Tray. So if you have to make ice in an ice cube tray, the regular ones suck. I hate them. They're like hard plastic. You put them in there, you freeze, and then you have to like twist them to pop it open. And then like
they pop all over the
they
place.
They pop all over the place, or you can't get them out. They're stuck. Silicon ice cube tray is really cool. First of all, it's like the ice cubes are a true cube with these, which is awesome. It's like something that bothers my OCD. But having a perfect cube makes me happy. And then what's cool about them is you can like they're soft silicone rubber, so you just like flip them over and you just sort of stick your thumb in it in the back and push the ice cube out. They don't fly everywhere. You get just the ice cube you want, you know, and it's super easy.
Yeah, I've actually been a friend of mine had one of these, and I thought it was the coolest thing just because it was silicone, it was rubbery, and you could just poke out individual ones. If you wanted 3 ice cubes, you could do that instead of just cracking them and having loose ones or like ones on the floor. And they were perfect cubes. They do look really cool.
They tend to not get, I don't know why they tend to not get quite as cloudy as the other ones. It's just a weird thing.
I've been trying to find them in, you know, just local stores, and I haven't been able. I mean, I'm not like, you know, looking,
oh, you were hunting
every store,
everywhere.
But every I do kind of tend to look for them, and I have never seen one in the store, so I might just have to get one here.
Yeah, they're $11.36 for a set of two, and they're really cool. I have a couple sets of them, and I really like them. Check them out. Get the link in the show notes. All right, let's get into our web apps. So our first web app, you and I have talked about before the importance of doing testing. We had an episode where we talked about really results-based web development was the title, I believe. And the whole point is like look at what's happening and develop based on what is happening and helps your app. And one of the tools that you talked about was A-B testing.
Right. I think we mentioned the Google one, which is Google Web Testers. Anyways, it's a A-B split test.
Right. So what NinjaButton
is... Web Optimizer. Google Web Optimizer.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. So NinjaButton is actually just a web app that is completely geared towards doing A-B testing for a button. So like your call to action button is very important. People say that, you know, you really need to keep track of it. And this app just does that for you. So if you want to say add to cart or buy now, you're curious which one will get you more things, you can sign up for NinjaButton and create two buttons and it'll keep track of it for you. Specifically with buttons. And what's cool about it is, you know, it's pretty cheap. And you know, it's A-B testing is really important.
Yeah, it's always if you can quantitate is that the if you can have quantitative data on your website, it's always better than just saying, well, I think we should, you know, change this around. And yeah, I mean, just check out the episode that we had on, I think it was evidence-based web development. A-B split testing is I've done it for ads, and believe it or not, like just different size ads, and it's not always the bigger ad will have better results.
Yeah,
and you can do placement of ads to see which ones get clicked more on a content type site. If you have an e-commerce site, this one's perfect because you know you just put it on your checkout button or your buy now button or add one to cart button.
Right.
And you can see, so how does it work as far as the button itself goes to a different page or?
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, the button is generated, in NinjaButton. They give you the code to insert it into your website. So you design the different buttons and they give you the code for the button on your website and then it just puts which button it needs and then records, you know, whether or not it was clicked or not.
So where's the split part? Does it put?
Oh, right, you select different buttons that you want impressed, and then it puts the code in, and the code selects a random button.
Oh, I see.
Right. Cool. So you get the code, and they even have a little free button designer, so you can kind of see what it's like to design buttons for them. They even have an advanced button designer, so you can design different buttons for your website. It's just, you know, if you just want to really, I mean, it's quick, dead, simple, easy way to get A-B testing on your buttons.
Cool.
Your call to action buttons, which are really like your call to action is one of the most important buttons you need to have on your website.
So yeah, whether it's sign up or buy or an ad.
Right. Well, yeah. So you need to try all those. Like you need to try and up sign up. You need to try buy. You need to try, you know, subscribe, A-B test and get the best results because you might want to, well, not might. You need to increase your conversions, right? Everyone needs to increase their conversions. So cool. Check it out at NinjaButton.com. The next web app that we want to talk about is really cool. So a while ago, long time ago, I think like in one of our first 10 episodes, we talked about Etherpad. And then in a subsequent episode, we talked about Etherpad going open source, getting bought by Google. And so there's some Etherpad alternatives out there. Etherpad is just basically, what do you do that where you collaborate?
Basically real-time
collaboration. Of just a text document. Well, we used to, you know, we'd play around and think like, man, this would be kind of cool for code. Well, since it's open source now, a group has actually taken it and you can go to ethercodes.com and it's basically an Etherpad implementation that has syntax highlighting.
Cool.
Yeah, and like in revision control. I mean, it's all the things you want. So if you want to work on some code with a coworker hyper collaboratively on different computers, go to ethercodes.com. You know, you just click create a new Ether code. It gives you a sort of a random URL, no sign up or anything. It's awesome. And then you can like select the language. It's loading right now, so I can't really tell you much more specifics than that. But it, you know, sort of gives you the regular Etherpad was like a white background with black text. It was made for like, you know, making outlines or doing text, you know, and it was really kind of, it was really cool, but not super advanced. You know, there wasn't like a lot of formatting or anything. Ether codes is basically the same way, but you know, it has like different colors so that it's more like a terminal. It's darker colors like you're used to programming in. It's being it's being awfully slow right now.
Yeah, I'm trying to get.
Are you trying to load it too? Yeah.
Yeah. This would be great for maybe in a presentation to kind of show code examples and let everybody kind of see on their own screen. Yeah. Maybe in a teaching environment.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great
pair remote pair programming, maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is with a lot of them, you have to share. We're a lot of solutions for sort of pair programming and stuff. There's like Transport on the Mac. You know, you could do, you could share your screen with Skype, but then really like one person's in control or the other person takes control of the other person's desktop. This is a way to do it, you know, simultaneously so that you could be Skyping like we are right now, looking at our sort of Ethercode page and talking about it while we actually type out the code.
This might be good kind of replacement for things like friend paste or paste bin. Instead, you could just paste in here and your friend can just start typing along.
Totally. Although you can't right now if it's working like this, because this is ridiculous. I'm starting to wonder because
it was down last week, and that's why we didn't talk about it last week.
All right. Well, I'm not even sure if this is that cool of a service anymore. Oh, very frustrating because I kind of wanted to show you everybody and talk about it. Anyways, check it out. Hopefully it'll be more reliable for you guys in the future. Go to ethercodes.com. If you guys have some news, a follow-up, or a web application you think we should take a look at, or a geek tool you want us to talk about, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can email us by emailing studio@faceoffshow.com. Go to twitter.com/faceoffshow. You can tweet us out there. Let us know what you want to talk about. We'd love to hear from you guys. We've had some great feedback from our listeners, and we really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Let's get into our topic this week, which is something we've been kind of thinking and talking about lately. And I mean, that's the mobile platform in general. This is exploding.
Yeah, just looking at the sheer numbers and the percentages, Android has gone up in just 1 year. It's like over 800%. This is a fast moving market, and it's something that I'm really interested in because I think, you know, while I know there's a lot more people getting smartphones, and yeah, I mean, a lot of apps need to be on, you know, cross platform. You need to be on the web, you need to be on the iPhone, Android.
Well, I mean, there is sort of the mobile web page, right, which is something you make, which is pretty easy to do. It's not that difficult, but it still is a hassle. I mean, I can tell you as an Android user, a mobile web page to me is still a hassle. I want like an app. I want it as an app that I click and it opens up. There's no browser. You know, I want it. I like the app.
Right. I mean, the app gives you things that, you know, like GPS coordinates, which you might be able to get with HTML5, maybe. But, you know, maybe accelerometer, notifications, push notifications. There's a lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of things that come native with, you know, like the Android or the iOS that you just can't get with a simple, you know, like HTML, CSS solution.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we will find out later in the show that there are some cross-platform ones that you can develop with just, you know, JavaScript.
Right.
And communicate with an API that communicates with the native OS.
Yeah, this excites me. So let's get, we mentioned a couple or some, but let's talk about like the major platforms out there that you would have to think of if you want to build an app. Like, so what's the biggest?
So when I first started researching this, I was really expecting maybe BlackBerry or, you know, the iPhone to be the most, you know, the largest platform, but it's actually Symbian. And I think it's because they've been around a really long time and they have a huge market share with Nokia and Japanese, you know, the foreign markets.
Okay.
So Symbian is the largest. They have 41% market share. It is open source now. That was announced a couple months ago, I think. They've totally open sourced it. The apps are written in C++, and you can develop for it for free.
Do they have like a centralized app marketplace?
I can look it up. I'm not sure. I should have put that down.
I guess I'll kind of answer my question. I'm not sure if they do. I'm trying to think if I don't think I've ever owned a Symbian phone unless I didn't know it.
Okay, so they have, they call it SIS deployment.
Okay.
So they have I don't know if it's an app store or like an area where you can go and browse them.
Okay.
But because I've like you said, you know, I've never had a Symbian phone, or never even, I haven't known anybody that's even had one.
Does Sony do Symbian? Is this a lot of the ones you mentioned in Japan? Are they the one? I mean, I guess I knew Nokia. Nokia was big at that, and Nokia is sort of big elsewhere in the world, right? I mean, like even in Africa and stuff, you see a lot of Nokia phones, which is funny because I think their U.S. market share has almost plummeted.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't see a lot of Nokia phones anymore in the U.S.
Sony Ericsson's another one that they're big on.
Right, yeah.
Which is overseas is a really big phone.
Right, like I know in Japan, I mean, Sony Ericsson is huge. They put out like a ton of phones.
Over 300 million Symbian OS-based units have been shipped.
Holy cow.
So that's a lot of phones.
So it's a lot of phones. So, I mean, it's funny. If you talk to most people these days, they think, oh, okay, I need it to develop for iPhone and Android. I mean, I guess those are the two I hear the most.
I think in the U.S., it's the case. Maybe if you know international Symbian, you might want to port your app to their platform.
Totally.
So the next highest one is actually BlackBerry at 18.2% market share.
Okay.
Their apps are written in Java, so that seems to be. Some of the other ones are written in Java too. Seems to be a popular choice. Mm-hmm. Their development cost to get set up and to get their SDK is free. They have an installer and packaging option. So they have a store, but you can also, if you were a third party developer and you wanted to like just have an app on your store,
right.
Or I mean on your site that people can go and download,
okay.
You can do that with a BlackBerry. Some of the platforms like, the iOS, it has to go through the App Store. The next one is Android at 17.2%. So they're just above the iPhone at 14.2%.
Right.
So Android is one of the fastest growing ones. They went up 800% last year.
Wow.
And they have, I think they said they had the most devices now. Something like 34 more hardware vendors are now switching over to Android. So this is the one that might end up being one to look for in the future, even though it only has 17% now. It's quickly growing.
Right.
It only had like 1.8% last year.
Yeah. And they're also at
17% market share now.
And the Android OS is actually also being sort of thrown in other things too. There's sort of like really small form factor netbooks, I think, that have them. There's now tablets coming out with the Android OS.
Yeah, I even devices. Saw they're making like Google TV, and they had a remote control that was probably going to run Android.
Right. What else? There's another thing I saw that was running Android ebook readers. Wow. it's really gaining steam.
So these apps, so Android apps are written in Java, but you know, if you really need performance, you can write them in C and C++. The development cost for these are, you can download the SDK. I believe Android is open source. So I believe you can even get the source for some of the utilities. The IDE is Eclipse by default.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can develop in Notepad if you wanted to, but they have an open marketplace, and they also have a packaging APK, so you know, third party, if you wanted to host off their marketplace, you could.
It gives you like a big old warning when you try to. It's like, whoa, just so you know, but it works.
I believe it's Amazon is making a app marketplace for the Android operating system that would be controlled.
Interesting.
But that's in the future. The next one is iOS, which is the iPhone. So this one, the first advantage is, you know, we got iPhone, iPod Touch, the iPad.
Right, very popular devices all over the place.
So yeah, I mean, you've got control on, I mean, on an MP3 player, on a phone, on an iPad. And I mean, Android is, like you said, they're coming out with ebook readers and lots of devices too. But for the time being, I mean, they have, you know, a wide array, set of devices there. They're at 14% market share. They just got passed by Android. The apps are written in Objective C. There is a development cost of $99 a year, to get the tools and to, you know, have a chance at putting your app on this on the store.
Right.
They do not have a third-party installer, so you could I couldn't like make an app, and host it on my site for people to come download if I didn't like their store. So there's one. I mean, there's a downside there. We see this in the news a lot, where we get companies, you know, like Google even, that
Right.
has great apps that get denied.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. It's sort of also a very black box system. You don't they don't really tell you a whole lot why you're denied or why it, you know, it's the whole process is not very transparent. You submit your app for approval. Sometimes it takes 3 days, sometimes it takes 2 months, and you're like, "What? I need to get this out on the App Store." You know, if you have a big bug, you know, it's sort of a crapshoot as to when you can get the fix for that bug out.
Right.
I guess the advantage is then that there is, I mean, there is a higher, I would say I've noticed a much higher quality in overall apps in the iPhone store versus like the Android marketplace.
There definitely is, without a doubt. So there, I mean, and security wise, I mean, it just there's a lot more. I don't know, pros and cons on that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
The next one
It's like the
is
forgotten child.
Windows. The forgotten one. That's just, I think they just released Windows 7 part of it.
Right.
So the Windows phones in general,
Windows
you know,
Mobile.
this is from Windows CE to Windows Mobile to Windows 7,
Yeah.
Windows Phone 7.
I know that platform well.
Currently, I was actually surprised by this. Currently, they're only operating at about 5% of market share on phones. They're kind of similar, you know. They have You can develop it for free. It was recommended that you get Visual Studio, but I think if you're a Windows guy, you probably have that IDE handy.
Yeah,
You can write in C and C++. What's that?
basically Windows Mobile and stuff, it went through a really big lull. For a while there, it was sort of one of the primary smartphone operating systems. Really, it was in BlackBerry. And then the iPhone came out, and Windows Mobile just didn't sort of have the jazz to keep up with like the iPhone and stuff. It just was, you know, very frustrating. As an owner, I know it was a terror. Sometimes the operating system made you want to pull your hair out. And then they didn't develop it on anything. A lot of people thought that basically Microsoft was going to drop the whole Windows, like the mobile OS thing. And then
Wow.
they made the announcement about Windows 7, which I'm excited about because I'm a Zune user. Is it really it integrates with the Zune marketplace.
Cool.
And it's got a
I did
really
read some
interesting user interface.
criticism that was saying that it was kind of optimized for a stylus instead of a finger, you know, for touch.
Yeah, that could
I
be.
don't and I don't know if that's for patent reasons or they think that people like stylus or
I don't know. This is, you
and
know,
I just don't
Microsoft
know.
just does some of the goofiest stuff randomly, and you never really know why. And you're like, people want to use their fingers. I don't want to use a stylus.
You just, I would be afraid of losing it. I don't know. I've never had a stylus, but
But it's a pretty interesting
anyways.
user interface, I think. I have seen a couple of videos of it and stuff, and it looks pretty unique. Whether or not that's good or better, I don't know. Time will tell.
So with that, I wanted to get to the part I really wanted to get to, which was the cross-platform development. I've never been a Java guy, and get into all that. So I really like the idea of these, and the promise of these is you can basically write with HTML and JavaScript, and you can and you interact with kind of an API, which then gets kind of scripted and made into the native code
Right.
for the app. And so Unify is one of those that looks really cool, which is open source. It's Apache and MIT, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Titanium App, which is also open source, but they have a commercial side of them. And then we've got RHO Mobile and PhoneGap, which is used in Unify. They look really cool. I really want to try them out.
Yeah, I think one thing that turned me off from Titanium, and I don't think Unify does this, it's like Titanium, I think to get native applications, you have to like submit your app to their web service, which then compiles it and does it. I found kind of odd. Hmm. To me, Unify looks like, and I could be wrong on this, this is totally speculation. The way it looks to me, I think in Unify, you write an app, and I think that what they have is sort of like a native sort of in-browser or a native viewer for each sort of device. And that's so it basically is sort of displaying a web page using that, what is it, Quidu or Quixu or whatever JavaScript
framework.
Oh,
I see.
So I think it's more of a, it doesn't fully compile over to native code. It sort of has a native interpreter that then sort of displays it, I think.
So you basically read it HTML5, CSS, with also, because I did look at the features and it had support for like the accelerometer and GPS.
Right, because that's how it gets to it through PhoneGap. It uses PhoneGap to do the interactions with the mobile device.
Oh, okay. So,
but it also works in Adobe Air too, which is kind of why I think that maybe that's why they just build sort of a native viewer on each of these sort of platforms, and then maybe sort of it can just run the native or run the code that you actually wrote. Titanium, really cool. I think it actually does. I think you submit the code and it sort of recompiles it and actually then compiles the entire thing down into its own app. But I'm not sure. This is total speculation.
But, you know, I mean, I'm kind of intimidated by the whole Android and having to use Eclipse and to run some compiled thing on an emulator and all this. I really like the idea of kind of just doing the whole web stuff and going with the Unify. So I really want to try it out. I'm probably going to.
Well, I mean, look at our app, AgileTask, right? So I would like to have a native iPhone app and an iPhone app and an Android app, and so that people don't have to go to the mobile web page. That's really all I want. But to do that, I mean, just to do that, I have to learn the Android SDK and write an app for it, and I'd have to learn the Mac one. I'd have to pay for it, you know, and have a Macintosh for development, which luckily I do. But I'd rather write from one code base and have it, you know, work on all devices. That's just easier. And if you don't want like super awesome, you know, whiz bang features, it will probably work.
Yeah, I mean, AgileTask is a perfect example. All we want is basically a form so you can add your task and maybe a button so you can see your today tasks or something. And that's really just it.
Right.
So
these things are, cool. are good for that. It's cool to watch these develop. I think it's they're going to be a lot. I think they're just going to get better. Really, I mean, that's all they can do is get better over time as they.
Yeah, I mean, you got to also remember this is a really fast market. I mean, a year from now, this all could be totally, you know, there could be some new one, or Windows 7 could be the coolest, you know, phone. It could have 100% market share.
Yeah, so check them out. Work on some mobile apps. That wraps up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. From there, you can get our Twitter links, our email address, everything, so you can tell us what you think and what you want us to talk about. Thank you for listening, and we will see you guys next week.